The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
When the Atlantic Monthly celebrated its 150th anniversary by publishing excerpts from the best writing ever to appear in the magazine, in the category of the humorous essay it chose only four pieces, one by Mark Twain, one by James Thurber, one by Kurt Vonnegut, and Ian Fraser's 1997 essay, Lamentations of the Father. The title piece of this new collection has had an ongoing life in anthologies, radio performances, and on the internet, and I can assure you a copy is going up on my refrigerator when I get home tonight. His work is funny, elegant, poetic, and highly literary. This new collection is a companion to his previous humor collections, Dating Your Mom and Coyote vs. Acme, and contains 33 pieces gathered from the last 13 years. He is a winner of the Thurber Prize for American Humor, author of the nonfiction bestsellers Great Plains, Family, and On the Res, a contributor to The New Yorker, Outside, and other magazines. Please welcome Ian Fraser to the Free Library.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm going to talk a little bit about literary humor. I'm advertised as someone who writes literary humor, and people ask me, you know, when I'm interviewed, people ask me what actually is literary humor. It's humor that also has the requirement, or it sets itself the goal of being not just a series of jokes, but an actual piece of writing and an actual work of literature. And what I love about the form is that although you start out with a kind of a basic premise, which is that you're going to try and make people laugh, and that you're going to do it within the context of within a literary context, but that you also have a chance when you do it of writing something that just sails on forever through literature. And the examples are not many that have done that, but they are wonderful pieces when you come across them. I think The Metamorphosis by Kafka. I think there's a humor piece, basically, and it just keeps on going. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie of The Producers as opposed to the play The Producers, but in the movie of The Producers, if you remember the plot, they set out to produce the worst play they can possibly produce in order to then keep the money that they raise after the play closes. And they're looking for bad plays. Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder are lying in Zero Mostel's office, and they're sitting there reading play after play after play, trying to find the worst one. And Zero Mostel picks up this script and starts reading it, and he says, one morning, Gregor Samsa awoke to discover he had been transformed into a giant cockroach. And he looks off in his face. He goes, nah, too good. Right? Well, that's, you know, the first line of The Metamorphosis, but it is also just a great story that, you know, sort of changed literature. And what I admire in literary, you know, in writing is writing that is really funny and is also great. To me, somebody like Samuel Beckett is just a hilarious writer. But there's something else that goes on with that. Nikolai Gogol, the Russian writer, is a hilarious, you know, the nose, about a guy whose nose just disappears, and then he sees it going around town, you know, like wearing a greatcoat and getting in and out of carriages and stuff. He says, oh, there's my nose. And he goes after him, and the nose drives off. Mark Twain's first funny piece that had a big hit The Jumping Frog of Calaveras County is just a wonderful piece, a totally strange piece about this jumping frog contest out in California. It's sort of a tall tale. And I had read it in collections, and when I read it in... I went to the New York Public Library, and I found the actual first edition of that book and in their rare books. And it's just this little book, and, you know, it's not a lot bigger than my book. It was Twain's first collection. And to see that piece in there and then to see the other pieces, it was such a stunning experience, because you read The Jumping Frog of Calaveras County and you go, ah, Mark Twain. You read the other pieces and you go, what is this guy talking about? You know, like jokes that have to do with San Francisco in the 1870s, you know, jokes that really don't, no, it was earlier than that, jokes that are totally gone today. And that is the beyond the main problem, which is simply writing something that makes somebody who reads it somewhere else laugh. I mean, right there, that's an astonishing to me. If you can do that, that's a great feat. Just imagine marks on paper that someone looks at somewhere else and laughs. Well, that basic challenge. Is difficult enough. But the other challenge that you have, and that really is the big, much bigger challenge, is time. Humor exists at a moment. The phrase, you had to be there, that's a fact of humor. You had to be there. And if you've ever tried to tell a joke to someone who doesn't speak your language, if you are sort of beginning, I speak some Russian, and I have tried in Russia to tell friends there something funny, you know, and just total incomprehension of that. You have to be there. You have to be in the culture. You have to be in the language, and you have to be in the moment. Works that transcend that are, again, very, very rare. And what happens, time is the great enemy of humor. So that what you're also trying to do is to write something that will be funny a long time from now. I do pieces that I really like to do things from pop culture. And about, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, I wrote a piece called Boswell's Life of Don Johnson. Now, Don Johnson is going over the horizon. So that joke was good when it started, but, you know, okay, you had to be there. You had to have seen about 20 Miami Vices. And the point of the piece was, like, you know, Boswell describing Don Johnson in Miami Vice. But now Miami Vice is, I don't know, probably it exists somewhere on cable, as everything does. But when you're trying to thread these various needles, that is, you're trying to make people laugh who, you know, with something written, and you're trying to transcend or find a cultural moment that everybody is on, you know, where everybody's sort of on the same page or sort of focused in the same place, and then do something that you hope will continue beyond your moment and will still be funny a long time after you're done. At that point, it's like you've raised the bar high enough that you're lucky to get one over ever in a lifetime. I mean, that's how I feel about it on that, with those criteria, you know, that's what you're shooting for. And when you do that, of course, you're also, the point of it is spontaneity. It can't seem like you've just been sitting there slaving over it. So it's I consider it a really worthwhile way to spend a career or spend a life. I haven't. It's not the only thing that I've done. I write a lot of reporting pieces, but I also almost futile nature of it. It's not quite futile. When I was in college and I was supposed to be writing a thesis, I set up a soda can halfway across the room and tried to throw a little bottle cap through the top of it. And I think I did it once in like 60,000 throws. You know, you're just trying it. But when you do it, it's quite satisfying. I write about, I like pop culture, and I just love to, you know, pay attention to, you know, what Lindsay Lohan is doing. It's just, it fascinates me. I like even stuff that you shouldn't be paying attention to because it's too stupid. Like Britney Spears' sister's pregnancy. You know, it's bad enough what Britney Spears does, but what her sister does, my gosh, where do you draw the line? But I really enjoy just paying attention to it. And occasionally you find things there that are just artifacts sort of that are really fascinating. And characters sometimes, when Bob Hope was alive, I just loved to follow Bob Hope's career because he was always, you know, I found him endlessly fascinating. For some reason, I have a fascination with Russell Crowe, and I realize I have two pieces in this that are sort of based on Russell Crowe. And on the other hand, I really like to look at high culture because high culture is something that when you get at the very, very highest levels, nobody ever makes fun of you, you know, and you probably should be. That is, you're made fun of only by people, often by people who don't understand you. That is, you know, Jackson Pollock might be made fun of by people who don't really know what Jackson Pollock was doing, and they say, you know, my kid could spatter paint better than you. And they, you know, it's not a very effective way of making fun of somebody. But sometimes, like, I read the New York Review of Books, and there'll be a review of some poet, you know, a very highly regarded poet. And I'll start reading, and I realize, you know, some of these poems are actually silly. And I don't know if the person is aware of that, because at that level, it's just not, you don't say, you know, that was really silly. I mean, I was reading about a performance right now in New York of a Philip Glass piece about Gandhi, and I know nothing about modern music, and I know less about Philip Glass, but there were pictures of these giant paper mache Gandhis that are part of the thing, people carrying away, and I just think, does anybody know that that's kind of silly? So combining high and low in that way sometimes can be really fun and can produce some sort of strange hybrid works. What I've done a lot, as I write reporting pieces, I find myself just getting more and more antsy to do something funny. And I don't know if the last time I was here, I had written a book about fishing. A book that I did sometime before that was about my family, where I went all over where we had lived out in the Midwest, and I went to the little towns where my ancestors had lived, and I read their letters, and I read their work. Many of them actually were ministers, and I read their sermons, and then I read the books that they had read. That is, if they referred to a book, I went and tried to find it and read it. I don't know if many of you have heard of the book Fox's Book of Martyrs, but it was a very popular book among Protestant people on the frontier back in the 19th century. And I read the Bible. And I really read it. I hadn't ever sat down and really read it. Just looking at it, it took me a long time, but just reading, you know, looking at every sentence in it. And it's just a wild book if you sit down and do that. And when I got to the book of Leviticus, I don't know how many of you have paid a lot of attention to the book of Leviticus, but it has to do with dietary and other prohibitions about how you can live and how you can't live. And just reading it, I thought, you know, how did these questions come up? I mean, foods that are allowed and foods that are not. You are not allowed to eat weasel. how did that come up? You know, there's a whole section of proscriptions of insects. That, you know, you can't eat anything that goes on its belly and has wings or something. There's a complicated formula for it. But it has to do with insects, what insects you shouldn't eat. But there are also insects that you can eat, which is really strange. You can eat locusts. You can eat grasshoppers. I realized that John the Baptist, who was famous for just living in the wilderness and wearing skins and so on, they say that John the Baptist, the Bible says John the Baptist ate locusts and wild honey. That's what he lived on. Well, he was keeping kosher. He's out there in the wilderness, but the locusts were fine. They're allowed in Leviticus. And as I was reading all these, it also happened that my kids were really young. They were, I had a daughter who was born in 89, then my son was born in 93. And I was a parent of my wife and I had these two young kids. And when you have kids and you're basically interacting with them all the time. I mean, when you're with your kids, it's just like they're constantly asking you something, doing something, and you're constantly, laying down boundaries for them. And I found myself saying all these things that all of my life before that and for the rest of my life, I would never say again. But I would say them just this one time so that my kids would get in the car. We'd have the groceries in the back seat. My kids would take their shoes off. The bread was on the top of the groceries. It was kind of pleasant to put your feet on because it was nice and soft. And I would look around, and both my kids were just kind of rubbing their feet on the bread that we had just bought. Of course, it's in the package, but still, you know, they're kind of... And I said, you know, don't rub your feet on bread. Am I ever going to say that sentence again? You know, going out, when you're in a parking lot, and we lived in Montana at the time, the cars are constantly covered with mud because we're going on dirt roads. And the kids, for some reason, they just like to... Kids will rub against things, you know. They get up on things, and they just kind of do this. And just to say, you know, don't rub against the car. Just don't, you know, you're going to come home all dirty. Well, how often do you say, you know, don't rub against the car? I mean, it was a kind of a process of accumulation where I just had these sentences. And they would keep, I would just keep hearing myself saying these things. And so after, a period of gestation while I was working on my family book, I had the idea of combining the pieces, the notes that I had taken on stuff that I had said to my kids with the sort of form of the book of Leviticus, with a sort of biblical form. And so that's what the title piece of my piece is, of my book, is Lamentations of the Father. And so I have read this before, but I will read it tonight, and I'm hoping that there are people here who maybe have said some of these things themselves. The title is Laws Concerning Food and Drink, Household Principles, Lamentations of the Father. Of the beasts of the field and of the fishes of the sea, and of all foods that are acceptable in my sight, you may eat, but not in the living room. Of the hoofed animals, broiled or ground into burgers, you may eat, but not in the living room. Of the cloven hoofed animals, plain or with cheese, you may eat, but not in the living room. Of the cereal grains, of the corn, and of the wheat, and of the oats, and of all the cereals that are of bright color and unknown provenance, you may eat, but not in the living room. Of the quiescently frozen dessert, and of all frozen after-meal treats, you may eat, but absolutely not in the living room. Of the juices and other beverages, yes, even of those in sippy cups, you may drink, but not in the living room, neither may you carry such therein. Indeed, when you reach the place where the living room carpet begins, of any food or beverage there you may not eat, neither may you drink. But if you are sick and are lying down and watching something, then may you eat in the living room. Laws when at table. And if you are seated in your high chair or in a chair such as a greater person might use, keep your legs and feet below you as they were. Neither raise up your knees nor place your feet upon the table, for that is an abomination to me. Yes, even when you have an interesting bandage to show, your feet upon the table are an abomination and worthy of rebuke. Drink your milk as it is given you. Neither use on it any utensils, nor fork, nor knife, nor spoon, for that is not what they are for. If you will dip your blocks in the milk and lick it off, you will be sent away. When you have drunk, let the empty cup then remain upon the table, and do not bite it upon its edge, and by your teeth hold it to your face, in order to make noises in it sounding like a duck, for you will be sent away. When you chew your food, keep your mouth closed until you have swallowed, and do not open it to show your brother or your sister what is within. I say to you, do not so, even if your brother or your sister has done the same to you. Eat your food only. Do not eat that which is not food. Neither seize the table between your jaws, nor use the raiment of the table to wipe your lips. I say again to you, do not touch it, but leave it as it is. And though your stick of carrot does indeed resemble a marker, draw not with it upon the table, even in pretend, for we do not do that, that is why. And though the pieces of broccoli are very like small trees, do not stand them upright to make a forest, because we do not do that, that is why. Sit just as I have told you, and do not lean to one side or the other, nor slide down until you are nearly slid away. Heed me, for if you sit like that, your hair will go into the syrup. And now behold, even as I have said, it has come to pass. Laws pertaining to dessert. For we judge between the plate that is unclean and the plate that is clean, saying first, if the plate is clean, then you shall have dessert. But of the unclean plate, the laws are these. If you have eaten most of your meat and two bites of your peas, with each bite consisting of not fewer than 3 peas each, or in total 6 peas eaten where I can see, and you have also eaten enough of your potatoes to fill 2 forks, both forkfuls eaten where I can see, then you shall have dessert. But if you eat a lesser number of peas, and yet you eat the potatoes, still you shall not have dessert. And if you eat the peas, yet leave the potatoes uneaten, you shall not have dessert, no, not even a small portion thereof. And if you try to deceive by moving the potatoes or peas around with a fork, that it may appear you have eaten what you have not, you will fall into iniquity. And I will know, and you shall have no dessert. On screaming, do not scream, for it is as if you scream all the time. If you are given a plate on which 2 foods you do not wish to touch each other are touching each other, your voice rises up even to the ceiling while you point to the offense with the finger of your right hand. But I say to you, scream not, only remonstrate gently with the server that the server may correct the fault. Likewise, if you receive a portion of fish from which every piece of herbal seasoning has not been scraped off, and the herbal seasoning is loathsome to you and steeped in vileness, again I say, refrain from screaming, though the vileness overwhelm you and cause you a faint unto death. Make not that sound from within your throat, neither cover your face, nor press your fingers to your nose. For even now I have made the fish as it should be. Behold, I eat of it myself, yet do not die. Concerning face and hands. Cast your countenance upward to the light, and lift your eyes to the hills, that I may more easily wash you off. For the stains are upon you. Even to the very back of your head there is rice thereon. And in the breast pocket of your garment and upon the tie of your shoe, rice and other fragments are distributed in a manner wonderful to see. Only hold yourself still. Hold still, I say. Give each finger in its turn for my examination thereof, and also each thumb. Lo, how iniquitous they appear. What I do is as it must be, and you shall not go hence until I have done. Various other laws, statutes, and ordinances. Bite not, lest you be cast into quiet time. Neither drink of your own bathwater, nor of bathwater of any kind, nor rub your feet on bread, even if it be in the package, nor rub yourself against cars, nor against any building, nor eat sand. Leave the cat alone, for what has the cat done that you should so afflict it with tape? And hum not that humming in your nose as I read, nor stand between the light and the book. Indeed, you will drive me to madness, nor forget what I said about the tape. Complaints and lamentations. Oh, my children, you are disobedient. For when I tell you what you must do, you argue and dispute hotly, even to the littlest detail. And when I do not exceed, you cry out and hit and kick. Yes, and even sometimes do you spit and shout stupid head and other blasphemies, and hit and kick the wall and the molding thereof when you are sent to the corner. And though the law teaches that no one shall be sent to the corner for more minutes than he has years of age, yet I would leave you there all day, so mighty am I in anger. But upon being sent to the corner, you ask straightway, can I come out? And I reply, no, you may not come out. And again you ask, and again I give the same reply. But when you ask again a third time, then you may come out. Hear me, O my children, for the bills they kill me. I pay and pay again, even to the 12th time in a year, and yet again they mount higher than before. For our health, that we may be covered, I give 1,580 talents 12 times in a year, but even this covers not the 1,500 deductible for each member of the family within the calendar year, and yet for our ordinary visits we still are not covered, nor for many medications, nor for the teeth within our mouths. Guess not at what rage is in my mind, for surely you cannot know. For I will come to you at the first of the month, and at the 15th of the month, with the bills, and a great whining and moan. And when the month of taxes comes, I will decry the wrong and unfairness of it, and mourn with wine and ashtrays, and rend my receipts. And you shall remember that I am that I am, before, after, and until you are 21. Hear me, then, and avoid me in my wrath, O children of me. My kids are now big. My daughter is in college, and my son is in high school. And when this came out, they didn't really... You know, they thought, well, I guess that's funny. But they didn't, you know, they thought, yeah, okay. And when I read this on the Prairie Home Companion, my son was listening to it, and he said to my wife, well, you know, I do that. I do some of those things. But they didn't ever really seem to, it still is not something that they quite see, you know. And I found it to be a really interesting way also of sort of looking at the Bible, in that you see that, especially in the Old Testament, God a lot of times has this sort of attitude where he's looking at the Israelites and saying, don't do that. You know, he's like a dad. It's just, oh, no, no, don't do that. No, you're not supposed to do that. No, don't do that. But then, of course, you know, he can, his punishments have a little more teeth to them. But anyway, that was pretty much what I had thought to say. And I'm told that there can be questions. If there are any questions or whatever, I'd be happy to take them. I think, I'm sorry, I should have said there are microphones because this is being podcast, so, or will be podcast.
Now, how do I put this? You've mentioned the silly, in a sort of derogatory manner. Well, then, what do you think of the, what shall I say, creatively silly, but in a relevant way, and are you a fan of Craig Ferguson?
A fan of Craig Ferguson?
Yeah.
I don't know anything about him, I'm sorry. But I have a friend who loves his, you know, Julie Hecht, who's a wonderful writer and watches him all the time. He has a real late night show, right? I don't have a derogatory, I think it's great to do silly things. I have, you know, I think the more, the better. I think, it's good to pick your shots with it, you know? I mean, there's certain things that should never be silly. Announcements on an airplane. I never want a silly announcement on an airplane. I don't go for silly in doctor's offices too much. And when I was in Russia, I saw a silly ballet. And I think ballets also should not be silly. There are just a few things, you know. So, I mean, as long as, I mean, if it's not something that's going to give me a heart attack, you know, like when the pilot says, ah, just kidding, you know, no.
I love your calling out silly. It does need to be done sometimes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Lamentations of the Father has been, it's number one on my list of funny things. I'm so glad to be able to hear you read it tonight.
Well, you're welcome.
I also enjoyed tremendously On the Res, which is so very, very different. Could you make a few comments about that book?
Well, On the Res is a book that came out in, I think, 2000, and it's about the Pine Ridge Reservation in western South Dakota, and this is the reservation of the Oglala Sioux. And I did a book in the 10 years before that or 12 years before that called Great Plains, where I traveled all over the Great Plains, and I knew I had been to Pine Ridge, and I knew a little bit about it. But it was also the reservation of Chief Red Cloud and the Oglala were the tribe of Crazy Horse. And the book about Great Plains sort of, Crazy Horse is sort of the hero of that book. So I had this real love of the Oglala Sioux over, you know, long experience reading about them, and then I had friends who were Oglala Sioux. So I decided to do a piece about, or a book about this reservation. And we moved to Montana, and I spent a lot of time on the reservation and did a lot of more research into the Oglala and into Native American questions, all different kinds, from casinos to self-governance to all these other sovereignty and all these other issues. So I made a book of this, and it is a nonfiction account, basically, of my visits to Pine Ridge and of the lives of my friends there. And Pine Ridge is just a very grim and difficult place, a very hard place to live. The alcoholism rate is, I don't know, 65%, 75%. The number of car wrecks is just staggering. The life expectancy is very low. The average age, I think, on the res is in the 20s, possibly. I don't know. It's one of the really hard places in this country. And so how would that jibe with writing humor? Well, the guys that... that I knew, my friend Le Warlance and his brother and some other people, they're very funny guys. And I think that there's a Native American kind of humor that just appeals to me a lot. And just the perspective, you know, looking from a completely different direction. You know, if you ever were a fan of Westerns, as I was in the 50s, and there's so many Westerns were out there, you know, the hero rides off into the sunset. or the fantasy of America is the open, like the end of the Great Gatsby, where he talks about, this country before the first, he says, Dutchman set foot on it, and this kind of Edenic idea of what America was like. If you've ever seen Shakespeare in Love, at the end, Gwyneth Paltrow is walking up the beach in Virginia. She's walking toward the tree line from a shipwreck. I hope that doesn't spoil the ending of the story for you, but she's walking into this Edenic picture of the of North America. And if you can imagine looking back and seeing the ships out there and seeing the people coming toward you and going, oh, no, it's just sort of a fascinating, different way of looking at it. And so I was really attracted to Pine Ridge by the humor of the people and by the just the different way of looking at it. Humor is a way of turning something and looking at it from a different angle and saying, wow, it looks funny from over here. It looks different. And I think that was a lot of what attracted me to Pine Ridge. But, it was inescapably sad as a place. And it was hard to give, both to do justice to how funny some of the situations were and not to be glib or, neglectful of the suffering there. So that was it was an interesting and difficult. It was a very difficult, experience, a difficult book to do.
Can you say who your favorite modern humorists are? Some who may have influenced you?
Modern, you mean of...
like in the you mean 20th century.
Yeah, sure. There are a lot. I mean, I'm from Ohio, and I love James Thurber. Even when I was a kid, I liked James Thurber. My father... loved to read Thurber, and I would see my dad sitting there reading something by Thurber and just laughing. And it was so hard to make my dad laugh. I might have made my dad laugh legitimately like four times in my life. I mean, I would try, but he just had a perfectly stone face, like, wouldn't laugh. And yet he had a very good sense of humor. And when I saw him reading The Years with Ross, Thurber's book about the New Yorker, and just laughing like to tears, and it was just like a miracle. I never saw my dad laugh that hard. And I never made my dad laugh that hard in my life. But Thurber was a big influence. And then, in Ohio, when I was a kid, Mark Twain was just everything. We did our little theater, did a production of Tom Sawyer. We read Huckleberry Finn 20 times. I mean, I have one friend from my hometown where we just talk in Huckleberry Finn talk, It's like just, Pap Finn monologues, where Pap is just like the worst guy in the world. But all these different kinds of phrases that Twain, brought into the language, it's just... I would say those two influenced me enormously. And then, you've had just this huge growth in the humor world in the last half, starting in the 60s, but it's just got more and more and more. So when I was a kid, Jonathan Winters is from near Dayton. And that was another kind of language that we just talked. We just talked Jonathan Winters all the time, Put down that groundhog, baby Elizabeth. You don't know where it's been. And play his records over and over again. And then we had a whole lot of comedians who came from right around where I lived. So people like Tim Conway, if you remember him. Bob Newhart wasn't from Ohio, but that was another guy whose records we played. And then we started playing Lenny Bruce, when I started getting old enough for that. And... that was because Jonathan Winters never even said a curse word, I mean, he had a piece about Broadway shows where he says, you know what they do in the Broadway shows? They say damn. And that was shocking, you know, in Ohio. Like, wow, you said damn and it's on a record. And, you know, like he says, they say it's damn hot in this town, you know. And that was as much cursing as there was. And then to listen to Lenny Bruce and just, whoa, where am I, you know. And but he was just like, you know, brilliantly funny. And then you had the kind of, at the end of the 60s, it just kept building and building, so that you had the National Lampoon, which started in like 74. And that was just, you read everything in it, and, you know, there were great writers, Michael O'Donohue, Doug Kenny, Henry Beard, George Trow, and getting kind of this, the humor at that time was taken on a real political content, and it was a sort of way that the revolution, which didn't really, you know, become that much of a revolution, could find an outlet, you know. If you've ever seen Animal House, I mean, Animal House is like, these are radical guys, right? They're going against the system in every way. But it's not like there's an overt political content. It's just they're going to rip up their school, basically, and make everybody, you know, they're just going to, it's just sort of random, wild behavior. But it did pick up, you know, political content. It did sort of take the political content of the 60s and gave it a place to go. And that's still what it's doing today. That's what Jon Stewart is. It's, you know, okay, we can't maybe really change anything. I mean, it does have a little bit of a futility aspect to it. But you know, but we're gonna be funny. Terry Southern was just, you know, or Dr. Strangelove. You know, I could watch Dr. Strangelove 1,000 times. I mean, it's just so. It was both a kind of literary, lot of literary influences, and then this just great kind of pop culture thing that happened, or, you know, kind of, you know, just with Saturday Night Live and the Comedy Channel. I mean, suddenly there was a channel that was all comedy. So it really did kind of, it was like a humor boom. And it's still going on. And I think it's great. I just, what kind of I find a little depressing is when every ad is funny. There didn't used to be funny ads. Ads were serious. They didn't want to mess around and maybe offend you. They wanted, in the 50s, you know, like, we're going to give you a serious ad. Now every ad is funny. And then you feel like the coin is getting debased a little bit. So, but that's sort of a thumbnail sketch of influences.
When did you find out that you can write funny?
Well, I mean, every time you hope that you do it. I don't know. I mean, when I was in college, I was on the Harvard Lampoon, and I was a cartoonist. And I had friends who were really giftedly funny, and I watched them write. And it was incredible. I mean, Doug Kenny, who was a lot older than I was, not like 7 years older, but he did all these really wild things, parodies of magazines. He wrote Animal House, you know. And then I still have a very good friend named Jim Downey, who wrote for, he's written for Letterman, and he's been with Saturday Night Live. And he did, I don't know if you saw this year, but there was some publicity for some notice of pieces that he did. He does the political pieces at the beginning of the show, and one of them was about Hillary Clinton saying, you know, how come everybody's giving Barack Obama a break, you know, and the newscaster's sort of fawning over Barack Obama. And that, you know, Hillary Clinton said, wow, that temporarily, you know, for that time had saved her campaign, or at least she was overheard to say that. So he's, like, gone on to do all kinds of things. And I would just watch him sit down and, you know, put a piece of paper in the typewriter and start typing, and it's really usually humor is done, like anything, almost anything done on TV is done with a bunch of people, because you write something and you think, is that funny? And if somebody else is laughing, you go, okay, that's funny. I'll believe it, you know. But it sometimes takes a group of people. An awful lot of humor that you see on television or in movies is done in a group setting. And so it wasn't so much I had always hung out with people, and I knew I was funny in a group, I mean, at least under the right circumstances. That was not so tough, because you'd be in a room and somebody would say something funny, it would go into the piece, you know. And then you'd say, oh, that was my line, you know. What was harder was to write by myself and sit there and say, well, I think that's funny, and I'm going to just bet that it is. I don't have anybody telling me, because I'm just sitting here by myself in my office. I don't know that this is funny. So that was sort of the tougher moment. And that was, I did pieces on the New Yorker where I would write something and, you know, and if I got a call immediately from the editor and he was laughing, you know, I thought, okay, after I turned the piece in, you know, and I just sit by my phone and hope. And every so often, you know, I would turn a piece in and he would call right back and he'd go, oh yeah, okay, that really works. That's great. So it was that sort of different time lag from hanging out in a group and knowing right away it was funny to writing it and then waiting and seeing if it was funny a little longer.
John Stewart, what do you think of Stephen Colbert?
Stephen Colbert lives in my town. He lives in Montclair, New Jersey. I think he's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and his producer lives in Montclair, New Jersey, and one of his writers is a good friend of mine. Yeah, I think this show's great. And it's one of the things that my kids really like too. So, yeah, I mean, it's a kind of humor that's, you know, it has a sort of a limitation to it in that you're not going to get all different kinds of funny pieces. They're all going to be sort of on different political, you know, topics. But I think he's really funny, don't you? Yeah. Yeah.
Doug Kenny and putting a piece of paper in the typewriter, and you've talked about writing in group and as opposed to writing alone. Describe a little bit, if you will, the mechanics of your writing. Where do you do it? How do you do it? How much time do you spend at it? What makes you write, or where do you get the mood to write?
Well, if I do humor writing, you know, if you write one funny thing in a day, I mean one funny sentence, that's good. You know, so it's strange. It's not like you can really say, I put in a good day's work, because what happens is you know, it might only end up being a sentence, you know. When I write humor pieces, I just sort of sit around and hope that I think of something, and I don't give myself more than a couple hours. I really try and do that at the peak of my, you know, interest and energy for the day. When I do reporting pieces, an awful lot of time, that just involves a lot of work. You know, so you're going through facts and you're calling people up and you're interviewing people. And I do a lot of work in the library, so there's a lot of research. So it's sort of two different kinds of work. But I find that one whets my appetite for doing the other. Writing humor, especially when you aren't thinking of anything funny, is really kind of a drag. You know, you're just... And you come down, my office is on the third floor of our house, and I come downstairs and I didn't think of anything. And it's sort of a, like, not a very pleasant evening, because I didn't think of anything. If you've ever seen, there's Richard Pryor used to go on Johnny Carson all the time, and he would be, you know, he's like the greatest, speaking of influences, you know, Richard Pryor was just like Lenny Bruce, you know, magnified sort of. But I saw Richard Pryor one time on The Tonight Show. He came on and he sat there and Johnny Carson asked him something. And he said, you know, I can't think of anything. God, that was so great. He said, I look in, there's nothing there. I don't have anything to say. You know, that's a person who's dealing with real inspiration. He's not going to fake it, you know.
You talked about time as the enemy of humor. What about context? In the several stories you've told us, you've given us the context mm-hmm. of how you got to that humorous mm-hmm. idea. And are there universal themes that don't require a contextual framework, or is it always going to be related to that?
Theoretically, there should be. I just haven't come across a lot of them. You know, I mean, if you think about it in terms of cartoons, there must be something eternal and cross-cultural about two people on a desert island. You know, because you see those in Italian newspapers, you see them in German newspapers. Everybody has done two people on a desert island. Doesn't matter what your culture is, you can do that. Unless maybe you actually do live on a desert island. But I have not, you know, I'm sure there are, you know, things that are universally funny. But I can't say that, like, oh, yeah, that one, that's funny in Russia, that's funny in, you know. I never came across that. And what I find reading Russian humorists, there's some really funny Russian writers from the time of Stalin. And the pieces that you read, the content, you got to sort of, I don't know, rewire your brain to understand the context. You know, there's a wonderful humorist named Mikhail Zoshenko, and he wrote pieces that really make me laugh out loud. But the context is, you know, like a guy goes into a bathhouse, you know, and loses the cloth that he wraps around his feet, right? Well, that's just not a common experience for people here. And yet it is really, you know, people do go to bathhouses all over the world, I suppose, but it's to me, the context is the thing. It's almost like that's what you're looking for. And once you've found that, you're okay. You know, I mean, the point of Don Rickles is the context of Don Rickles. That is, you know, you're in a Vegas kind of place and everybody's dressed up and going out and they all think they're kind of swell, and Don Rickles brings them down to size. And without, you know, that seems to be like, okay, he's found it. It's almost, it's like saying, you know, the snow leopard is great, but you've got to have the environment for the snow leopard or you're not going to have it. So that I really think it's much more like you look for a context, and suddenly one will appear, you know. I mean, Stephen Colbert, that context didn't really exist. And then suddenly it did, because you had a cable channel where you had a show with that niche, small niche audience could be profitable. You know, the thing that Colbert always takes from Bill O'Reilly is Bill O'Reilly's always saying, "Ha, well, look at my viewership and look at yours. I got 500 times the viewership you do." But the context changed, so you could do that show that's talking just to the people who are going to like that show. And then, you know, that changes again. So it's much more like you go around looking for the context as opposed to looking. I have never found a universal context for humor. I it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I haven't stumbled across one.
Isn't there something about the context of writing for The New Yorker?
Yeah. That was when I first started out, I loved it. That I thought it was so cool. I still like it, but I mean, as a kid, I just thought, "Oh my God, that's so cool!" And then at the same time, there was such unbelievable highbrow, you know. I mean, you know, Hannah Arendt on thinking, right? How many people sat down and said, "Ah, here's a new piece by Hannah Arendt on thinking"? Well, somebody obviously did. And when that's sitting there, you can put something next to it that's totally ridiculous, and it looks really wild. You know, here's Hannah Arendt on thinking. And as it happened, at that time, I had written a piece, a parody of a football all-star team, and it was called the Sandy Frazier Dream Team. My nickname is Sandy, and every player on the team was me. And I drew all these. It was like the most narcissistic, crazy piece, but I did all of these different And I just said, you know, how incredibly great a football player I was, you know. Like, not only is he huge, he's incredibly fast, you know, and each description was basically that. And that was on one page, and I think On Thinking was like on the, if you turn the page, there's Anna Arendt On Thinking. So I had that backdrop, and I could always come out and do something ridiculous or just... wow, you know, what is that doing there? So that, you know, the first piece that I did for the New Yorker that got attention was Dating Your Mom, you know, and I was 25 years old and I wrote a piece about how to go out on a date with your mom. Well, most of the people reading the magazine were the moms. They weren't, you know, so it was, you know, it, but having that backdrop, and I miss having that distance because I was young and most of the people that were writing were old, much older than I was, you know, and much better writers and much more experienced and you know, serious people writing about serious things in the world. And it kind of gave you it sort of slingshotted you forward when you did a piece like that, the fact that you were next to, you know, a William Trevor short story or something that was the people would be talking about. And, you know, this guy's a Nobel Prize winner. You'd be next to I.B. Singer, you know, like some really cool I.B. Singer story. And it was just, that was a lucky decade or so that persisted. Maybe, I guess, should I say one more question? Any more?
You grew up in Ohio. You live in Montclair. What do you think of New York City?
I grew up in Ohio, and New York was where I went when I got out of Ohio. And I wrote a piece about that was in my book before this one. But I think it's the greatest place in the world. I mean... And it's hard to describe without sounding like boosterish and corny and everything, but I think it's gotten better in my lifetime. I mean, I liked the real, when I first went there, it was really dirty and crime infested and difficult to, you know, you got ripped off in your apartment all the time. Your apartment got ripped off more, but you could afford the rent. And now, I don't know what kids are doing now. But I think it's also gotten better since September 11th. I think that people understand what they have in common and stuff like that. My daughter works for she's working this summer for the New York State District Attorney, and she works downtown. And, you know, we had 100 and whatever degree heat. Everything went out, you know. And just to see, I happen to be in the city too, and we're coming back. And just to see the way people... there's a real common feeling now that I didn't get before, that, you know, people understand this is an important and common effort, and that I didn't feel before. Now I really feel that people understand that this is a common enterprise in New York. And, you know, it's a tough decision because Montana is really great and I'd love to be in Montana, but New York, we were always coming back for visits, and finally we just moved back. So, anyway.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.